From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, in our penultimate show, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Nathaniel Ian Miller about his novel, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, published by Little Brown. Nathaniel Ian Miller, who raises beef cattle in Vermont, has written for the Santa Fe Reporter, Durango Herald, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Missoula Independent, and Virginia Quarterly Review. He received his BA from Amherst and his MFA in creative writing and MS in environmental studies at the University of Montana. Here's a little information about his novel, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven. In 1916, Sven Ormsson leaves a restless life in Stockholm to seek adventure in Svalbard, an Arctic archipelago, where darkness reigns 4 months of the year and he might witness the splendor of the northern lights one night and be attacked by a polar bear the next. But his time as a miner ends when an avalanche nearly kills him, leaving him disfigured. And Sven flees even further to an uninhabited fjord. There, with the company of a loyal dog, he builds a hut and lives alone, testing himself against the elements. The teachings of a Finnish fur trapper, along with encouraging letters from his family and a Scottish geologist who befriended him in the mining camp, get him through his first winter. Years into his routine isolation, the arrival of an unlikely visitor salves his loneliness, sparking a chain of events that will bring Sven into a family of fellow castoffs and determine the course of the rest of his life. The Sunday Times picked The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven as one of the best historical fiction books of 2022, calling it a striking first novel and an unusual, surprisingly witty tale with a memorable central character. When I spoke with Nathaniel Ian Miller, I began by asking why he chose to write this novel as Sven's memoir instead of a more conventional narrative. And so we begin with his answer. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It was just amusing to me that this character would ever conceive of his, you know, his life story being a memoir. You know, it was not a word that he would necessarily use except in a kind of amused way. And so it began as kind of a joke. And I think the title, I don't know if this is suitable for public radio, but the title was originally The Memoirs of, or Seal Sven, a Memoir. And and then it was The Memoirs of Seal Sven. And so I had to slightly sanitize that. And, you know, but as far as the format goes, I knew it was going to be first person. And in terms of it being like an artifact, that appealed to me early on as something that, you know, he, as a reader, would appeal to Sven. And, you know, as a form, he's grown up with their own sort of pompous self-importance. And so a memoir, you know, it's something that he could both secretly take seriously and also mock himself a little bit with. And then once the story is complete, it does have this, I think it has a kind of found artifact feel to it, as though it has to be separated a little bit from the kind of something's just first person.
Right, right.
As though the narrator is speaking directly to you. This had to be at a kind of remove, like Sven is speaking to an imaginary reader. He's projecting onto the page.
Yeah. I do know a little bit about your story and Sven's story, but for the listeners, what, if anything, is based on a true story here?
Sure. Almost none, almost nothing, maybe 0.0005% of it, I would say. It's the quick background is that it's based on a real guy about whom we know almost nothing.
Okay.
And when I was up there in Svalbard, and saw his hut. I was given no preface, no real preamble. It was just, oh, here's the hut of this guy who lived alone here his entire life, and his face was mangled in a mining accident, and his name was Stockholm Sven. End of story. And I was able to find very little else about him. You know, basically that he had come from Stockholm. He had been mangled in an avalanche in a mine in Longyearbyen, and then removed himself. And that was all I really had to go on for the entirety of the composition of the novel. Only later did I learn a little bit more.
Oh, wow.
When I was able to get hold of a book. And in translation, it was originally published in Sweden and then translated into Norwegian. And a Norwegian bookseller was kind enough to not only send this book to me, but translate the relevant passages, just talking about various interesting characters up in Svalbard, written in the, I think, 50s. And it mentioned a few times Stockholm Sven. And of course, I instantly saw how far my character had diverged from the real guy.
Right.
I'm glad that I didn't know these other things about him, the real one, because I would have tied myself in knots, I think, trying to shoehorn his life into my characters. And it just wouldn't have worked as well. And not to mention, not only that the real guy didn't live very long. So it would have had to be a shorter one. And, you know, things like that.
Well, now, I have been on your website and I've seen a picture of a cabin. Is that his cabin?
That's the one. Yeah. Rødfjordhytta.
Wow.
That's the one.
And I was going to ask if you're an adventurer at all. And I know that you went on this big trip, so maybe you could talk about that.
It would be generous to call me an adventurer. I'll gladly take it, but no, I mean, it was an artist residency that I was a part of in 2012, and it's called the Arctic Circle. It still exists, thriving as far as I know. And nowadays, I think they have two or even three voyages per year. Back then it was just one, I think, and maybe two. And we're talking about maybe 20, 25 artists going aboard a ship and voyaging around. At this point, we weren't circumnavigating, but around the northwest shoulder of the archipelago of Svalbard. And this was in 2012. I don't know if I just said that. I happened to be the only writer aboard that year. The rest were painters, musicians, all kinds. And we would make land most days by zodiac. And the painters would take out their easels and the musicians had their microphones making weird recordings. And I just had my notebook and camera. And the original plan was for me to write about the bad old days of Arctic exploration and the people stuck in ships and scurvy. And that's what I had been writing about. That's what I wanted to write more about. I needed to see it for myself. But when I saw this hut, Sven's hut, and heard, you know, I heard this little bit about him, and it's such a tiny little room, a tiny little artifice in this almost unimaginably vast landscape. And I've always been interested in these stories about isolation, and how human beings survive, how they have to adapt to survive, what reasons they have to come up with to survive. And so, of course, I latched on instantly to who this guy might have been.
Yeah.
And how his life might have been altered by this experience or shaped. And I I trashed my original project idea and just started thinking about Sven at that point.
Although you must have been able to use a lot of your notes for Sven and his story too, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. All those notes kind of went into informing the landscape descriptions and the smells and the sights, and also the city. You know, because we went to Pyramid Inn, although it would have looked much different in Sven's day.
Right.
But strange, ghostly mining towns and all that.
And Sven's day was just about 100 years before your trip, right? I mean, he's like, I think the book starts in 1916 or?
Yeah, yeah, just about 100 years before us.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Now, you have a prologue in the book, and it begins, "My name is Sven." It's just a couple pages. And I'm curious, from the writer's perspective, when you think a prologue is a good idea and when is it not needed, do you think?
That's a very good question. I didn't think it was needed. Well, I should back up. I had a very different beginning, and it was one of these flash forward type of beginnings. You know, it takes you right into the middle of the story in a moment, you know, like a photo of a moment, right? And kind of at his nadir.
Right.
And I don't know, I've always been drawn to that kind of thing, and then it never really works out and ends up being changed at some later time. I like to try to plunge the reader into a unpleasant moment, and then invariably an editor or, you know, a wise friend or my wife says, no, you know, you're running the reader through a gauntlet too early on. You know, nobody's going to want to continue past this like initial wash of misery. So, and, and they're right, of course. And so that gets scrapped. And I think it was my editor at Little Brown Ben, George, who said that not only did I need a different beginning, which had become clear to me by that point, but that something very simple, sort of introducing with Sven introducing himself might be the better approach. And for me, I knew I had this epilogue in mind for, well, I'd written the epilogue, obviously. And so it made sense to sort of bookend it with a prologue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, early on, we do learn that Sven is a bit of a curmudgeon, certainly as a younger man. And that, but because it's a memoir and because it's a retrospective beginning, we kind of have a sense that he has some perspective on his nature by the book's end. One of the things he says is that he had a general lack of enthusiasm for work of any kind, which I thought was funny. but also he's not very kind to his sister, who he loves, and her husband. Do you mind if I read a paragraph?
Of course not.
So this is from very early in the book. "Adulthood is not often kind to the closest of friends or kin. I did not care for her husband, Arvid, who was a boor. Always cheerful when he saw me, always generous with the modest comforts of his kitchen and home, and always rebuffed by my coldness. Often I would use elevated language I'd learned from reading Nansen and other great men, striving only to alienate us further. It gave me no joy, but I did it anyway." So I thought that was really interesting, particularly because it was from his own point of view. And I wondered if this is just part of creating a backstory, or did you want to, or were you very aware as you created his backstory of forming a character who will desire eventually to be alone, very alone? That just seemed like such a perfect way for him to behave before he is a recluse. Was that always on your mind?
Yes, it was, because that was sort of my earliest vision of him. I had to get him to the place of extreme isolation in a logical way. But at the same time, I think I default to writing characters with some degree of disaffection and alienation. I think that that's where I almost always begin. I'm not sure I would know how to write a well-adjusted character. And so I'm fine writing characters that learn maybe how to be somewhat well-adjusted by the end of a book, perhaps, or find some sort of equanimity with life. But I can almost never begin with them in that state. Back when I was trying to find an agent for this book, I had a conversation with one who I ended up not working with, who really couldn't understand Sven's motivation and wanted it to be much, much more clear and specific on the page, the source of his alienation and his disaffection. And I just thought, if that's not something you can take for granted in much of humanity, maybe the book's not right for you. For me, that's kind of the natural state. Is not to say that cruelty is, or the way he acts. That was his unpleasant behavior toward his sister, for example, is more just. I do think Sven is hard on himself as a writer, but he's also brutally honest, and I think he's making it clear that young people, particularly young men, and of course he's not that young at that point, but I think he's got to be in his 30s at that point or close. But anyway, it takes some. I'll back up and say, if the book is about Sven becoming a more rounded human being, a complete human being, then, you know, he has to shed some of his selfishness and his desire to be alone.
I say that again, his desire to be alone
is like a function of his self-absorption.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. That you faded there for a second. All right, great. And, you know, it's interesting what you said about the agent. I think that's such a good story to share on a show for people who are trying to write, because I think, you know, you hear that you have to find the right agent. You have to find somebody who understands your work and is going to be a real advocate for your work. And everybody doesn't read everything the same way. And I also think people who make their living trying to clarify fiction sometimes overdo it, or are certainly capable of trying to fix absolutely every single thing. And some things just are, you know, I mean, some people just are curmudgeons, you know. I think that's a great story to share, because you obviously found an agent that worked well with this book.
It was a process though, Shayla. I mean, it had over 200 rejections.
Really?
From agents.
This book basically in the same form?
Oh, yeah. Almost exactly the same form.
That really surprises me. Oh, my goodness.
And this is the second novel I'd written. My first novel, I'd gone through the same process of rejection. And so the novel before it, which is still unpublished, I was actually represented twice by two different agents. Mm-hmm. Each time was a bit of a disaster. And so, you know, starting fresh with Sven and having this long, long process of trying to find an agent. And as you said, so this conversation that I mentioned with the prospective agent occurred right in the middle of that. And it would have been tempting to just bend over backwards to try to make it fit to this guy's vision of it, since at that point I was so desperate for representation, but it just really was not right. It didn't feel right.
Oh, and my goodness. So that's amazing. That's amazing. On two levels, that's amazing. I can't believe that you would turn down somebody at that point in the process, and that's really says something to your own advocacy for this novel, but also just that this novel is so good. I'm so surprised that it took that long. I loved this book so much, and everybody I know who read it loved it so much. I can't believe it took that long. Did you have a lot of people saying maybe and then saying no? I mean, how was it just a lot of form rejection?
all form rejection. And every once in a blue moon, I could get somebody to read a sample. But for the most part, you know, I'd say 98% of these rejections, they never saw the book. And so certainly that's a testament, at least in part, to my query writing skills, but also just, you know, the monumental slush piles.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them for, you know, missing so much of what comes their way, because how can they possibly catch things in this, you know, enormous glut? And
right.
So, I mean, the system is really a problem for debut novelists. And I don't know how anyone gets through other than sheer luck or connections, which I didn't have any of. And that certainly that would have been useful if I knew somebody who knew somebody. And in fact, what ultimately helped me get the agent who represented Sven and who's my agent now is that one who read it and turned it down was kind enough to say, you know, this isn't right for me, but it may be right for my friend, this other agent, and gave me his email.
Mm-hmm.
And he ultimately, many months later, became my agent. And so that, you know, that form of connection worked for me. But it was certainly hard earned. And I'm lucky because my wife took over the process. I became so demoralized so early on by the rejection. You know, my ego cannot withstand that kind of war of attrition.
It's a horrible, horrible aspect of this business. It really is.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. And actually, I think this one of the secrets is that, you know, when I couldn't get people to even respond to my query letters, and she took over, and the query letter remained essentially unchanged. And I don't know how much you would call this like a ruse. It was certainly unintentional. But so you'd have my query letter with my name at the bottom and at the top, just like a standard letter. But it would be coming from her email inbox. And so what the agent would see was an email, not from Nathaniel Miller, but from my wife. And her name is an interesting name. It's this heavily Irish name.
Uh-huh.
Peculiar spelling. And then so the agent would open that and read my cover letter with my name on it. But I really believe, because the minute she took over the process, we started getting responses.
And that is so interesting.
People asking, you know, for partials or even a full manuscript. And not that the luck was instantaneous, but at least we were getting responses. And I really believe that was just because so much of it is like, you know, did the email come in while they were at lunch or, you know, on a bad day for them or, you know, were they not feeling well or whatever? And some of it is just like, well, that's an interesting name in my inbox, you know.
Yeah.
I'll click on that.
Speaking from the point of view of a person with a very interesting and hard to spell first Irish name, I will say that's not necessarily always the case.
you're punching a hole in my whole theory, Shayla.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about the book. So I think it can be very hard to write strong emotions. Sven suffers a terrible accident at one point in the novel, which changes his life and results in nicknames such as Stockholm Sven of the Mangled Face and other things. He later experiences other forms of violence and peril. And I'm just wondering if you, when you come to writing strong emotion or like fear, terror, do you draw on your own experience to write about that? Or do you kind of like go to some sort of meditative place where you embody Sven in order to kind of get to his emotions? What, and I'm not asking you for details of your personal life, but I'm just curious, how do you go to writing more emotional prose?
Sure. I think if it's a choice between, you know, the first choice and the second, at least in terms of Sven, I'm knocking on wood right now. Yeah, I haven't had too much, say, physical trauma in my life. And, you know, the emotional stuff has been of a very different sort. But mm-hmm. I'd say some of the extreme, especially concerning the, you know, violent trauma in Sven's life, that is more of a meditative space, trying to put myself in Sven's shoes. I don't have a lot I'm drawing on in that case. I have more to draw on in terms of his, you know, the highs and lows of his mental state. Mm-hmm. That's something I can really project into a character. But yeah, just in terms of the really harsh stuff, that was mostly, you know, informed invention. It's something I've been thinking about a lot because I just finished writing a new novel, and it's so deeply informed by my own life and experiences that I'm still so deep in the process that I almost can't remember what it's like to fabricate from whole cloth emotions that are so alien to me. And I wonder, you know, can I do it again next time?
Okay, that's interesting. I want to talk a little bit about setting, in particular, I want to talk about the lack of light where Sven is. And he describes the lack of light as having more in common with cold than anything else, not so much searing as taxing, more a slow poison than a knife. And he goes on to talk about how the lack of light personally affects him. I thought about that as just a really interesting part of the setting. And I wondered what it offered you as an author in terms of Sven's character, but also if you could talk a little bit about writing this setting, which is so different than most.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, an extreme environment like that is rich in terms of giving you a kind of a palette that you can use to illustrate the interior life. I mean, it's perfect. I found it perfect for a story where a character spends so much time alone or just in his own head. You know, that so much of what occurs in this book is in his own head. It's a monologue. And I think that to have this kind of canvas of, I don't know, it's hard to put into words, but both the bright white, that's sort of, as it has classically been depicted, this the empty canvas of the polar regions, in terms of, you know, this sort of just the big white.
Yeah.
That paired with, you know, the long night. These are, I don't know, I think of it as the parallel is sort of like when you're lying awake in the middle of the night, as I do, and the way thoughts seem to have endless room to spin out, and not always in good, or not even often in good or productive directions. But I think of the landscape that way as a place for things to spin out and unravel. So much room for the interior to take on a larger role, if that makes any sense.
It does. Yeah, that's wonderful. It's funny because it is a kind of romantic, I think for some people, particularly maybe people who moved to Vermont, it's a kind of romantic ideal, this idea of the cold. I remember once seeing this is going to sound silly compared to what we're talking about, but on Facebook, I have a friend who put out this thing saying, I would like more, can you suggest more television shows where there's like a detective in a cold climate, it's freezing, he's drinking
cold coffee. He's divorced. He's miserable. And it's like, for some reason, that's very romantic to some people.
Yeah, I mean, look at the massive audience for Nordic noir.
Exactly.
And I have to ask you, what is it that keeps drawing people back to these very bleak stories of misery in a miserable place? But yeah.
That's true. Actually, in rereading your book for this interview, it got me sort of excited about polar exploration stuff. And I've started watching this show on Hulu called The Terror, which is very frightening. So I can thank you for that.
No, the book, The Terror, is really fun. Dan Simmons.
I haven't read the book. Okay.
Dan Simmons, you know, he's writing for a more commercial audience in some ways, but he's a tremendous historian and researcher, and he brings a lot, just like, say, you know, Bernard Cornwell does to his pulpy, you know, like Viking books, but bringing a lot of research to bear and integrating it fairly seamlessly. And so The Terror is wonderful in terms of not only like a fun, scary story, but also how much you could learn about John Franklin and that particularly horrendous doomed expedition.
Yeah. I love that book. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the wonderful characters that Sven encounters. He has a niece named Helga who appears early in the story and then ultimately has a larger role to play. But he also comes across other people, Charles McIntyre and a trapper named Tapio, if I'm pronouncing that right. Can you talk about finding these secondary characters and developing their idiosyncrasies and were they created specifically from your own imagination, or did you run across people in your research that sparked these fictional counterparts?
Yeah. Well, once again, these characters were fabricated from nothing, and that's something that I really haven't done in this new book that I'm writing. So I'm having to wonder, did I really do that? And
isn't that funny how that happens?
How did I do that? But yes, no, they didn't have any particular inspirations in terms of real people or people I've read about or know. You know, in some interviews, I've tried to draw parallels and could say, you know, there's a little bit of my mom and Charles McIntyre, I suppose, but it's a stretch. And for the most part, they were fulfilling needs in the story and needs in Sven's life. I mean, I think of, say, McIntyre and Tapio as these sort of alternate poles in Sven's world, mm-hmm. in grounding him, shaping him. They're essential not only to his continued existence, his life, but also to his growth as a human being. And they fulfill very different roles. And so that's something that evolved on the page. And then, of course, people like his niece and his sister, you know, maybe they arose originally out of my desire to write interesting three-dimensional female characters and try to put them into this so heavily male environment. And then, you know, they grew from there, and their importance to Sven and his life and growth. Not that they exist for his growth, you know, but that their importance became clearer to me as on the page. Mm-hmm. But I did know from an early point that the story was going to move toward Helga's appearance in Svalbard and a very different sort of role for Sven, mm-hmm. once she arrived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because his sister's children, of whom Helga is one, offer him the opportunity to be a better person at two different points in his life. And I like that. I liked that aspect of this book. I also really liked that that these other relationships, these other characters that I said are, you know, are wonderful characters. They're also, they are, it strikes me that in these circumstances, like if Sven went to this mining town, you know, these people might not have very much in common other than needing to earn a living, and it's a hard living. And yet relationships will form, even though people might not have that much in common or they come from all different places. And I loved that aspect of it, too. You know, these cold cities and out, there's another place later in the book where he goes. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting which one that is. But, you know, he encounters Russians and...
Pyramiden, yeah.
Yes, all these different people that come together and have these wonderful relationships. I just loved how you did that. I admire when people can write characters well, but I think something that is overlooked very often is it's different to write characters and to write relationships. And I think writing relationships well is equally important, and you do it so well. Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. What is your approach, and what is revision like for you? Are you writing a series of full drafts, or are you fiddling as you go? How do you work?
Well, let's just pretend that I have a process while I answer this question. Let's certainly, my process in terms of a discipline is severely lacking in terms of, you know, how often I sit down to write and that type of, well, I guess they call that writing hygiene sometimes. That doesn't really, there's no such thing. But in terms of revision and the process of getting the words on the page, it's certainly what you mentioned in terms of fiddling with it constantly. Mm. As it's going down, I tend to write very slowly for that reason. You know, it'll take me hours to write two pages, and sometimes not. Sometimes it's flowing more consistently, but I do a lot of adjusting of the sentences as they're going down. And whether because of that or because I'm a terrible prima donna, I often am unwilling to change them much after that point. Once it's, you know, its original form is often the form I'm unwilling to depart from. And by original, I mean what I leave on the page after, you know, hours of working with it. And so revision after that can be a bit like torture in that, you know, at that point I'm kind of wedded to it and I don't like to make major alterations. And having been an editor in the past, there's two forms of revision that I kind of don't really mind. One is, you know, tightening, distilling, that I'm happy with. You know, if an editor says to me, you know, this needs a lot less, or we need to get here faster, that's something I can really work with. And I don't mind removing, excising so mm-hmm. much. I like to do that with kind of a scalpel. Or if in terms of fleshing out and developing, I might moan and groan about it, and protest that I like to keep things elliptical and barrel Bainbridge-ish, but I can go in and create, you know, or I can add to a scene or something like that.
Right.
If that's really, if I've prevailed upon that that's necessary. But in terms of like the sentences themselves at the sentence level, I've spent so much time thinking about the musicality or lack thereof in a sentence and the rhythm and how one sentence fits with the one before it or the one sentence three, four, five sentences before it or how a paragraph ends or the shape and how a chapter ends, those things I will just dig my heels in and refuse to change.
Okay. Are you the sort of writer who might have an active message in mind about the book as you write, or even on your office wall? I know sometimes people will put some sort of message or mantra on their office wall to keep in mind some major message about the book or some major theme. Are you that type of writer?
No, not really. I mean, no. Sometimes I'll, you know, I think as far as I get with that is like putting up a few photographs. You know, I'll change my, you know, my desktop to an image that I find relevant or inspirational. That's about as far as I go. What does surround me instead and is less, significantly less helpful than what you're describing is like a thousand post-it notes and scraps of paper. I mean, that's, if you want to talk about a process or a lack of a process, that's my process. I mean, I go through the day and as little things occur to me, I'll scribble them on everything. And, you know, the classic receipts and post-it notes and yellow legal pads and backs of other drafts, and they just form this kind of it's like this hellish, chaotic collage surrounding the computer, and that I have to somehow, you know, organize. That's my process.
Okay. Okay, so I always like to ask my guests what are some books that they've read lately that they would recommend to listeners. Do you have any recent, like, one or two titles that you would recommend?
Sure. I, a couple of months ago, started for the first time reading an Icelandic novelist who's very big there. I mean, they say he's you know, the heir to laxness. He's also very big in France and some other places, but he's still not published here, as far as I know. He's been translated into English, and he's published in the UK, and his name is Jón Kalman Stefánsson. And he has a trilogy. He's written many books. He has a trilogy that begins with a book called Heaven and Hell, and that's a book that heavily influenced the one I just wrote, which takes place in Iceland, and really rewired my brain, as I think one of the characters in my book even says. That book really kind of turned me over. I mean, it was incredible. Heaven and Hell. Unfortunately, I think you have to order it, you know, from, you can't get it through an independent bookstore here.
Oh.
But that one really was stunning. So
now the book that you say you've just written, is that the one that's very much based on your own experiences?
It is.
Okay.
It's kind of, I think anyone who's lived in Vermont, for example, especially in proximity to Vermont farm life of any kind, which is, you know, pretty much anyone in Vermont lives in proximity to farm life, will recognize it as a kind of projection, or at least a close parallel to the Icelandic farming that I'm describing in the book.
Oh, okay. And you do farm, correct? Is that... That's your main occupation other than writing is farming.
Yeah. I think it's the proportions have changed finally, where now I can say my main occupation is writing, but that's a new development.
Okay. And what kind of farming is it?
Beef cattle. I used to raise pigs as well, but every year I said never again. And I finally lived up to my promise and we don't have pigs anymore.
Okay. Does it smell better? I don't know.
Yes, it does.
I remember. So. Yeah, there was a pig farm near us that did not smell very nice.
No, I mean, even we never had very many. I'm talking four or five at a time, and that's enough. I mean,
okay.
A real pig farm. I went into one of these industrial pig farms in Wyoming near where I lived, and the smell, and that wasn't massive, like one of these operations down in North Carolina or something, but it was a pretty serious hog farm and indoor, and the smell was so intense and pervasive that it got into my clothes, and I never could get the smell out again.
I had to
throw my clothes away.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's serious.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I just have really one last question for you. And it requires me to read again. Do you mind if I read another paragraph?
Of course not.
Okay. Part of this is I just want to share some of your beautiful prose, but the setting is so wonderful. So here we go. We climbed, and I stared down at my labored footsteps until at last we stood on a mild summit. I gasped, both from the chill air I sucked down in great gasps, and from my wonder at the sheer vastness of the land and sky retreating from view in all directions. The snow had subsided, clouds moved at great speed, causing the light to change with weird frequency. In many places in the world, one's view is restricted, so one comes to rely upon a certain constancy, or at least a measured pace, to sun and sky. When the heavens begin to rush about in haste, it is usually the preface of a fearful storm. So if one lives in a land where the wind and clouds have nothing to obstruct them for miles upon miles, one must become acquainted with a sense of ongoing meteorological alarm. I loved that moment, and I don't think I've ever experienced that, so it was kind of cool to read about. But my question is, I always end the interviews with asking for advice for other writers. And in your case, and you can actually take it wherever you want. You don't have to answer this particular advice question. But I am curious about writing setting when you are not in a place, even if you've been there, but especially maybe if not. How do you, you know, what advice do you have for people who are writing setting and they're not right there to kind of experience it?
That's such a good question. I hope this isn't a cop-out, but I really can't. And I try sometimes to write landscapes. You know, I was a nature writer, quote unquote, for many years. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of my schooling, my writing schooling. And so my approach has always been to be there, take 1,000 notes, some photographs, and translate that into prose. And so maybe I'm limited in terms of my approach, or spoiled, but when I attempt to write landscape description without having seen a place, I invariably fail. So that's why I had to find my way up there, not as a tourist, but for something more extensive, mm-hmm. or to get to Svalbard or anywhere in the Arctic or Antarctic I would have gone, just so I could get that feeling and write some things down, because my imagination, maybe I have a limited imagination, but yeah, when I've tried, I've often failed. I mean, for example, like in Sven, as the book ends in France, I don't spend a whole lot of time trying to describe the landscape around Dieppe in Normandy, because I've never been there and I can't. And I it's something I've tried to do and I always fail. I mean, like the book that I wrote before Sven takes place inside a fallout shelter. And that's something, you know, it's this finite space, it's concrete, it's steel. I can put my imagination to work there.
You go down in the basement and...
Yeah, right. But a landscape, there's so many smells, the sounds, the birds, there are no birds. You know, these are things where a photograph on Google is just not enough for me. And by the same token, as a sort of related note, I felt liberated by something I saw recently, and this is like a tangential response to your question, which is I saw something advice, and I really am not good at advice, or have none. But a quote from George Saunders, and maybe you saw this. I think I saw it on Twitter, and somebody had said, attributed this to Saunders. So I don't know if it's true or not, but that when asked about a writer's style and what makes a writer's style, did you see this thing, Shayla?
I don't think so.
He said, and I'm paraphrasing here, I'm probably paraphrasing inaccurately. he said, well, for example, I don't like reading landscape descriptions, and so I don't write them.
Wow.
That's my style. And so that caused me to think, okay, well, that's interesting in several ways, as a sort of illustration of what how a writer's style can be not only what you include but what you omit. Like for example, I almost never write physical descriptions. I obviously had to for Sven in terms of his mutilated face, but for the most part, I don't tend to spend a lot of time like Annie Proulx does, describing how a character looks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not visual that way. I get lost in it as a reader, and therefore I don't attempt it as a writer. And lately I've been thinking that landscape descriptions, while they can be beautiful and lyrical and poetic, are often hard, at least for me as a reader, and maybe I'm empathizing with Saunders here and undoing my years of nature writing, but I read them and I can't visualize. And so as a writer, I think what I'm attempting to do in landscape descriptions, and I think in the past, and in some places in Sven, I think I've overdone it. And, you know, you're trying to describe something in a new way, new metaphors, interesting language. And really, it's complicating the scene unnecessarily. I'm still happy with the section you just read, because I feel like the ideas and words are plain enough that a reader can get a visual idea of the place. Whereas sometimes I get bogged down in metaphor, and, you know, this looked like a hunk of cheese, or, you know, I describe a glacier as like looking like a hunk of cheese. And I'm thinking, what does that mean to a reader? And what would that mean to me if I'd never seen it? Maybe nothing.
Yeah, I think the thing I loved about the paragraph that I read for this moment in the interview is also it's very active. Like, there's something going on in the landscape that's unique, and I felt like I was able to experience it, and it's something I've never experienced, so that was kind of cool. I want to just mention again that the name of the book is The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven. It's actually a novel by my guest today, Nathaniel Ian Miller. It's published by Little Brown. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Shayla. This is really fun.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Nathaniel Ian Miller. You can learn more about his work at nathanielianmiller.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Nathaniel Ian Miller, who recently heard someone extol the virtues of writing about one's work. And Nathaniel commented that he likes this idea, he would like to see more of it. The supposedly mundane aspects of a job might be considered boring by the person doing the job, but that person will know all kinds of detail about what they do in their work. And so that actually might make it very rich for readers. So this week, give that a try. Write about your work. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. So if you've been listening to the show, you might already know that Write the Book will will complete its 15-year arc next week with an interview with author, Vermont author and activist Bill McKibben. So that will be our last interview. I hope you will tune in. The podcast will continue to be available at the website, writethebook.podbean.com. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Okay, I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.